every time you did, I had kind of wandered off someplace else.
Well, you keep doing, if one keeps doing that, and like, you know, often the instructions I've heard, you know, for many years is like, oh, you wander off, get back to your object, get back to your object, get back to your object. One of the most important things I ever did in my practice was figure out why have I left to begin with. Mm-hmm. And that's actually one thing I forgot to say. There's such an emphasis in the teachings often in the West, how they're portrayed around pleasant and unpleasant feelings. In actuality, I find I'm quite convinced that the driver of the problem is neutral feelings. Is that we, and there is a, in the lesser, the suit on the lesser questions and answers, just means it's the shorter suit on questions and answers. They're not less important questions and answers. There's two suttas. It's between Dhammadina and her former husband, who's a lay supporter. And she says that when seen with wisdom, neutral sensations are seen as pleasant. And when not seen with wisdom, neutral sensations are seen as painful, unpleasurable. And fundamentally, what I think it is just we can often express this in the simple vernacular of boredom. Is that we start and we sit down and we have like some kind of volition, like I'm going to achieve something or I'm going to have some calm state of mind. And we work on a little bit, we work on a little bit, and then we're like, okay, enough of this. Let's see. Our mind goes off and, you know, let's go play with some thoughts. Let's go run over some story from work or something like that about he said this, she said that. Next time I'm going to do this. It's because we've just gotten into a state of boredom or state of neutrality. And when you look at the totality of one's experience, if you could do a statistical analysis, the actual pleasant and unpleasant states of mind are actually quite small. It's mostly neutrality. And if you're okay with neutrality, you're equanimous, then you don't flicker, you aren't playing the game of going back and forth to these very flickering stages. I had this visualization in my mind at one time where I thought, like, if you had these, like, if you had a bar graph of these three states, it would appear to most people that neutrality is a very small sliver in the middle, and pleasant and painful, or pleasant and unpleasant, are the majority. But actually, that's not the case. It's much more the neutral. But when you actually see the development of the mind, and if you, like, consider what's happening in the four states of the jhana, we're actually, all of that sphere of sensory awareness is becoming more and more, we're becoming more and more cognizant of it being neutral, and we develop those things that used to cause us pleasure and pain, those we just become equanimous to. We develop neutrality towards things that used to either upset us or grab us with a sense of desire. You know, some at a certain point where you're just like, well, it's just food. It's just this. It's just that. It doesn't really matter. So the range of which our experience is becomes more prominently neutral, and we become more aware of it being neutral. But if we don't do that and we continue to play the game that neutrality is a negative, or we don't recognize it as it is, we'll constantly keep bouncing back and forth to the painful and the pleasurable. And we won't progress. We'll just keep playing that game. And that game will last forever. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so and that's why I like the idea also of dwelling, is recognize that, you know, all training, this is like, you know, I like the similes of like sports and music. I did both of those. And, you know, you practice to pass the puck or you shoot the puck, mm-hmm. or you practice your scales, but that's not... that's not where the rubber meets the road. It's in the game where it matters, and it's you know, in the performance. Like if you have to play a song, that's when it matters. And these five hindrances are the hindrances that we have in our day. You know, these things are more commonly really experienced in the world, but we don't stop to recognize it and like associate the things that are happening on the cushion are the same things that are happening in our day-to-day life, but they're more prominent. We kind of say, well, I'm not supposed to be doing that now. That's supposed to be for the other time. Right now is the meditation time. Well, that's not it. This is just all a continuum of life. And to try to stop separating them is very important, to recognize that the mind state that you have on the cushion is a reflection of the mind state you have in the world, and the mind state you have in the world is a reflection. What you think and say in the world is what's going to happen on your cushion. They're related. Mm-hmm. So when you reflect, why am I, okay, I've lost the breath. Well, it's because I keep thinking about this. Well, that's because all day long I've been thinking about that. And so why is that the case? Is it some action I'm doing? Is it how am I holding the relationship or the situation, right or wrongly? Is it around a sense of self? Is it around a sense of like, it shouldn't be this way, it should be permanent, I don't want this person to pass away? Well, they're going to, you know, how are we reflecting? There's all the different myriad of teachings that the Buddha has, but you can't go into all of them. But I'm trying to get beyond, one a part of this talk is get beyond the idea that a technique is the root of what practice is. It's a whole way of looking at your life. And just sitting is a part of that.
In the beginning, Ajahn used to say that your meditation doesn't end when you get off your cushion. It keeps on going.
No. Yeah, and that's exactly why this kind of thing, specifically in your meditation, like if you specifically do this, I've wandered, where have I gone, and why have I gone there? Not a lot, because your object is to stay, to discipline the mind to stay with the breath, but just a little bit. If you do that, you will start to develop the karma to do that during your day.
Mm-hmm. You get more done because you're more...
Well, you'll be like
bouncing around.
Well, I use that chime thing once an hour. Bing, bing, bing. And then after you do it long enough, you're like, you know where you're at. Like that's really the state of the mind that really gets there when the hindrances disappear or they become extremely suppressed. It's a continuum. The hindrances become less and less and less of a problem. And then you get more and more into the state where you know you're in a hindered state. Like there's sensual desire here, but I'm not moving. My mind's not moving. There's anxiety or aversion to this person or this situation, but I'm not bothered by it. I'm not picking it up as a thought. So, but that there's a process to getting there, and that process to getting there is not just like, I'm staying with the breath at the touch of the nose. Mm-hmm. That's it. That's the whole, you know, it's no. That's just an anchor for the rest of your reflection on your mind. Like, oh, okay, my mind's wandering and I'm creating suffering. I do that every day. I do that all day. And this is a chance to sit there and see it and reflect on it and develop the skills, like working on your notes, working on your scales, working on your stick handling and passing. In your practice, your one-hour meditation, you really, in my opinion, should be using that not just to like say, oh, do I need to scan the body in this way or should I scan the body in that way? That really isn't, those things have value, but that's not really the value of meditation. The real value of the meditation is to see what the mind is doing and figure out why it's doing it, and then it'll stop. That's the nature of it.
You're talking about ill will. So... I'm not sure I'm more stuck in it. I don't think I'm stuck in an ill will, but more probably an aversion. My brother's living in our house again. And I just want him to go someplace else.
should I pause the recording? Well, you know, the thing is about family is, like, this goes back to that little bit I was talking about, was a little bit of a sidestep about the nimittas and stuff like that. Mm. People, you know, when they're family and friends, they that are real close to you, you've developed a lot of conditioned responses.
Oh yeah.
And yep. It fundamentally doesn't matter even probably what he's doing now. It's like
Yeah. For the most part.
Yeah, it's like that's just like, you know, long pause, somebody asked him one time, how come my parents know how to push all my buttons? And he's like, they're the ones who put them there.
Exactly.
Yeah, so.
Exactly.
Yeah, you know, so.
Yeah, because I seem to be more angry with him than not, you know. But in some days, I'm not angry with him. It's like he's nice to have around. And other days, he just drives me absolutely bananas and I just wish he would move far, far away.
Now, I'll ask a question.
I don't want him to be you know, suffering or anything like that. I just want him to be someplace not where I am.
So the nature of the hindrances, I should have brought this up, but now we're in the questions and answers. I'll bring it up now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
These five categories, these hindrances, one will see over time that they're patterns of the mind that have nothing to do with the object of the state.
Okay.
So, like, and they'll come and go in different waves. One might be an aversive type, you know, kind of ill will. And if one is that type, one's going to find something to answer that call whenever, because it's a coping mechanism to deal with all suffering often. And so you might just be having a bad day and you need a reason to have your bad day. Like, you're just having anxiety and ill will, and here comes somebody who can satisfy that feeling. I saw this one time with my dad. We were watching the Penguins play, and they weren't having a very good game. And you could see his temperature bulb rising. And my cousins and nephews, or my nephews and nieces, are running around like chickens with their head cut off, because that's what they are. They're kids. They're like 5 years old, 6, 7 years old. And they've been doing this for hours. I don't think they ever stopped the whole time I was there. I was there visiting. And goal score on the Penguins. Gosh darn you kids, stop, blah, blah, blah. And it just goes off on this tirade on the kids, and you're like, it has nothing to do with them, you know? And this is what we're often doing with the hindrances, is that we don't want to be doing this task. And I'm talking now in terms of the formal structure, but also in life. Well, let's say we're doing something like, I got to do my taxes. You know, I don't want to be doing the taxes. And then somebody, you know, that has a relationship issue you might have with it can be aversive. Well, it's time to snap at this person because I just don't want to be doing my taxes and I have a negative state of mind. So the mind was often is really, it's looking for objects. This is sensory indulgence is this way. Like, we just, I remember this quite, can't do it as a monk, but you know, you're supposed to be doing something and then you're standing in front of the fridge.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I'm supposed to be doing something. Well, I think I'd rather have this candy or these cookies or this cake or this pizza. And so we don't want to do something, so we go off and find something to indulge in as a form of avoidance.
Yeah, I do that with book work sometimes. I don't feel like doing it, so I'll surf the internet and check my email multiple times.
Well, the internet is, it's designed for this.
Yeah. We did it so we wouldn't care. So they could do whatever they want with the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm. So I overheard the conversation, wasn't there?
Yeah.
And you're saying, look, the state of your mind. So you got me on the second two, by the way. The first one, I was good. The second one, I was thinking, cool head, warm heart. And then the third one, I was lost in visions. But first one, you didn't get
We're
it.
Not keeping score.
I am.
I can see.
But anyway, so you're saying how, like, it's a reflection of your mind and, like, just not on the cushion. And that's actually how I got through the cooking today. I was like, because, like, I had a mess everywhere, and I was like, okay, let's just get the allowable tray done. And then I'd get lost. I'd be like, nope, like, allowable tray. And I kept having to do that. So it's like, I'm just saying, like, that is...
you were asking about, like, and you've had these questions about the fundamentals of practice. I just want to... This is why laying this seed down that, like, I'm obviously a big proponent of, like, full body awareness and the body meditations and stuff like that, and anapana. But they really should be anchors in many ways for this kind of contemplation that you should continue to try to work on. Like, where have I gone? When you go away, why has my mind wandered? Where has it wandered? And then by doing that and lifting it up, instead of just going right back to anapana or whatever it may be, or body or metta or whatever you're working on, and it, that's the thing, is you develop this skill, it can work with all those other ones as well. You say you start working with metta. May all beings be happy. May I be happy and peaceful. May I be free from suffering. May I be liberated. So you start picking up that as a practice. You're gonna dwell in that sometimes, and sometimes you're going to go off into a hindrance. If you put this as a fundamental nature of your practice, like, okay, my mind has wandered. Where is it gone? Okay, make a note of that. And then it's useful at the end of, like, 1 hour, the bell rings, to spend 30, 45 seconds reviewing how the sit went. It's been agitated. It's been calm and still. It's not a judging thing. It's just a lifting up and a recognition, because then this is how we see, like, really long-term patterns, like, especially, like, in retreats, but in our lives as well, is like, well, I keep having these thoughts. Maybe it's because I keep writing about them, or maybe it's because I keep thinking about them, or maybe it's because I keep talking about them. That's what karma is. So this is how we connect with our actions, because we've often talked about, what is this self? What is this going on? It's just these patterns of actions and the fruit of those patterns of actions. So by developing the skill to recognize the patterns can be changed from unwholesome to wholesome.
Does it matter if, like, I know, like, I'm not going to say what is it, but you know what I'm talking about, I just don't want to say it or anything, but, like, how I figured out, or I think I figured out why certain things happened in interactions. Like, and you're saying, well, why have I wondered? Why? Like, different topic now. Does it matter if we figure out the actual why?
Well, it's useful, like, to do, like in the sit, like, it's really not so good to be, like, allowing this as an opportunity to proliferate on thinking about whys and wheres and whatnot. No, you should, in order to develop the discipline, you should make a note of it, like, my mind's wandered, this is kind of an aversive state, I got to get back to the breath. And then at the end say, my mind wandered a lot, and it was mostly around aversion, and it's around this one state. Summarize, brief, not much. But then through your day, I mean, that's the thing, you're here for long periods of time, or, you know, in the world, not on the cushion, or unless, or you can set up specific sits specifically for this as well, like, where I'm just going to sit down, it doesn't have to be on the cushion, but I'm going to sit down and think about where my mind's been lately, and try to figure out why I've been thinking these things, or why have I been acting like this, why have I been having these kind of problems with people, whatever it may be, and sit there quietly and try to sort out the problems in an aggregate way. And then this goes to things like self and not self, impermanence and permanence, suffering. Those are the three marks of characteristics of existence. So those are like kind of subtler layers underneath the five hindrances that is usually the root of the hindrances. And mostly it's around self and impermanence. Those are the, you know, suffering is caused by those two things.
When you say impermanence, are you just mean, like, I know what impermanence means, but, like, it's a great coffee mug, but it's probably going to break sometimes. So.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, that's a classic. Ajahn Chah actually used that, but that's a pretty, you know, it's pretty mundane. It's more, you know, when it comes to real suffering, it's like thinking you're not going to die, thinking your parents aren't going to die, thinking your loved ones are not going to die, thinking your job's going to last forever, thinking your health is going to last forever. Thinking that your tranquility here is going to be fine, and not recognizing that somebody could show up that you don't get along with. But another thing, another way of translating Nietzsche, is uncertainty. So they're hand in hand, like impermanent because we don't know when it's going to come into existence or non-existence. But it's also like your day is uncertain. So Nietzsche is a dhamma. It's a multifaceted word. We tend to use mostly impermanence, but it's also, Ajahn Chah, you emphasize more like not sure, not sure,
so
not
like
sure.
So doubt as well?
It's not doubt. It's not sure about what is happening next, or what's going. Doubt is more like, I'm not sure what I should do, whereas not sure is like...
Or you just can't predict the future.
Yeah, you can't predict the future. Yeah, you don't know when that mug's going to break down. I mean, that's a really simple example, but you don't know what your day is going to be like. So there's some anxiety just around that. They go, okay, and often that's a real driver for many people. They're like, okay, I was supposed to go to work, and you weren't supposed to bother me. I'm supposed to do my work. And like somebody comes up and goes, well, no, this deadline's changed, and you got to do this. And you're like, well, but I already have my day. It's on here on my planner that I'm doing this.
That's me.
That's a Nietzsche. That's not sure. That's not sure. You know, so you grasp that is what is going to be. And that's suffering, because you don't know. It could be like death comes and taps you on the shoulder and says, you know, you got this plans for this afternoon, but come with me. Someday.
So Sila is morality?
Yeah.
And Nietzsche is what you just said?
These are two separate threes. We're really good with numbers and different things, so keep these two separate threes separate.
Okay.
The three legs, the three parts of the training, Sila, Samadhi, Panya, which means morality, ethics, one. Samadhi, concentration, stillness of mind, two. Panya, wisdom, discernment. Those three are parts of the training. And they are things that, like, if you don't have a moral life, your mind's never going to get concentrated, because you're going to be dealing with all the repercussions of your immorality. If you don't develop concentration, all three of them have to work together in developing together. They often assimilate as like three legs of a stool. If you got one of them short, you're going to tip and fall off your stool. So, and if you don't develop insight, like if you're just sitting there trying to say, I'm going to concentrate on getting this breath to one point on my nose, I'm going to concentrate, you're never going to get anywhere, because you're not learning. That's a big part of what this talk is about. Is learning, why is my mind hindered? Where is it going? Why is it doing these things that are not in accordance with my general intention? So that's how you develop insight and wisdom. Now the other three are called the three marks of existence. And that is impermanence, suffering, and not self. I don't like that order, to be honest with you. The Buddha's order. So it's hard to argue. I think impermanence, not self, and suffering is a better word for me. Because things aren't permanent, they're always changing. Mm-hmm. They're not me, they're not mine, myself. And when I grasp those two, they're heavily related, it results in suffering. But so those three are separate from those other three. Those three characteristics underlie all of existence. And fundamentally, not seeing them as they are is why we have the hindrances and suffering on top of them. Because we want things to be permanent. Mm-hmm. We want things to be mine, myself, or own them, or have some sense of becoming or being. And then suffering is all around not seeing correctly. It's usually also, that's in, like, if you look specifically at the Sabbasava Sutta, it's reflections around your future and your past. And not seeing that as suffering, or not so, Four Noble Truths.
Like, so just even thinking about future or past is like a form of suffering.
Well, you know, we're gonna fall on our razor's edge.
I'm just gonna bring that up.
I mean, you have to plan for the future.
Like, I'm planning for the future right now by practicing this and dealing with my mind.
Yeah, but yeah, you incline your mind, you incline your whole, yeah, there's wholesome karma to the future, but there's like, if your happiness is dependent upon it being that way, then you're grasping it too tightly, you know what I mean? Like, I had this idea. I was going to have that white picket fence, you know, fancy car, nice wife. And I got everything and a great job, and I had all that. And I was like, really? That's it? This has not lived up to the billing. And so I, you know, and then I came across the Dhamma and realized that that wasn't ever going to be it. That isn't really what I wanted. That's what the world told me I should want. And I went and did what the world said I should do, and it just was empty. It was like just not really there. I mean, it was okay, but it was like, for me, dukkha, some people get hung up on the word suffering, and I think that's right. So it's more like that matrix, you know, the matrix, like just a sense of like, something's not right. And that's this idea that we're coming from a sense of, I am doing this, I am that. And I will be here. And all that is fundamentally not true. And we, deep inside, know that we don't really have control. We're just pretending we have control. We know we're not really going to be here, but we're pretending that we're going to still be here. You know? Eventually, the reality is going to hit us right between the eyes. And can't avoid it. So there's this inherent nature that is just unsatisfactory and like, deceit. It's a self-lying. A lot of it's self-deception. You know, and that's, the West has gotten really good at it. Like, oh, the body, we'll just stick it in the ground. you know? And like Thailand, these other countries, they put it up on the funeral pyre and are like, okay, everybody come look at it. This is what's going to happen to you. It's pretty gross looking. Turning colors, flies are having dinner. You're next.
Fine.
But we put makeup on it, stuff it with fluid, stick in the ground, and pretend that you can come visit it, and it'll be there forever. And the part that's not there, it's up there forever.
Or down there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or over there.
Nobody thinks they're down there or going there. They all think they're going up there. Even the ones that are not so good.
Yeah, that's a tricky one because like I can sit here and say, yeah, like I know I'm gonna die, and everyone knows that death is a thing. But like, has anyone actually accepted the fact that like, hey, we're gonna?
Well, so this is very important. Like, this comment you're making is of significance. And we've talked about it a little bit. Sometimes you got to come around and hit somebody with an insight. Like, this is what we're talking about when I talk about the three levels of wisdom. There's told wisdom, intellectual reasoning wisdom, and then there's experiential wisdom. Somebody could tell you you're going to die, and you could be like, oh, okay, I accept it. That's weak. You could actually look at pictures and or see and know people and really think about it and intellectually understand, yeah, it's inevitable I'm going to die. The real kind of penetrating wisdom, this knowing and seeing, is seeing like the death of oneself. This state of mind, the deathless, it's even referred to in the suttas, is a seeing and knowing that there's nothing here to die. There is nothing here to die. So you fundamentally die to the world as a construct, mental construct, before you've physically passed from the world. Because you've transcended the body. You've transcended the idea that the mind is self. All the five khandhas are transcended: perception, feeling, consciousness. Nibbana is this experience that says unequivocally these five things are not to be considered me. They can cease, and there's something beyond the idea of death. So that's the experiential wisdom. So whenever you have this thing like, well, I get that, that's good, but not good enough. Like you got to keep pushing until you experience things that change your mind. All three of those grades help incline one to more wholesome karma, but it's the karma that leads to the end of karma, and that's the transcendent. And keep working. Mm-hmm. You can do it.
When we have the three, sila, I forget what they are, but do they need, do you have to, you said it's three legs of a stool, can I have wisdom? Work on wisdom and then, still maybe not have the other two, but you know what I mean? Or is it they all go up?
Well, I actually just saw that they're it could also be kind of considered concentration and insight. There's the, we've had this, I think, talk a couple weeks ago, Vipassana and Samatha arrived. One can lead the others. I'm a strong believer that concentration is led by wisdom, but that's myself. That's my own personal thing. I think that they're, and the Buddha says that sometimes they emerge together. Morality is you got to do it. If you don't have the morality, you're not going to, that's you got to do it. And sometimes, but morality improves with wisdom and concentration. Because through the clarity one see, and the stillness of mind, one sees that really wasn't a truthful statement. Or I was really exaggerating. You don't see that with clarity. So wisdom does get supported and grow, but there's a certain degree of morality that has to be in place in order to calm the mind and still the mind and see wisdom. But the other two can be, some people are just they sit down and they're I'm just going to stay with the breath, stay with the breath, stay with the breath, stay with the breath. They get samadhi and then they can develop wisdom from there. I personally am more from the school of my concentration really, or samadhi came from seeing the not self in my mind, seeing the karma oriented towards why things were rising and passing away. I did this investigation I just described here, primarily, I would say 2011 is when I was cooking on this specifically, around I was using the term vitaka vichara differently, like the commentarial way, as opposed to the way I use it now, which is more like the directing of the mind. And every time my mind wandered, I would be like, why is it wandered? And I would look at specific, like say even nimittas and triggers and sounds. But sometimes the mind will wander because of like say a bird, and then you'll associate that bird sound with the fact that you were walking and saw that bird, and at the time you were thinking about something. So that thought will come up. That's how associative the mind is. It is a highly, I call it an associative matrix. So that wisdom, when you see that, makes you really dispassionate towards thinking, because you recognize you're really not one who's really directing thinking so much. It's pretty much just a process that goes on. And so it loses its efficacy. And that may or may not be for you. I mean, I'm telling you a little bit of my own personal thing. But to answer your question, the three need to be pretty even, but one can lead. Like panya can lead concentration. Concentration can lead panya, wisdom. And for yourself, you should, this is a part of the personal journey, is figuring out what works for you and what doesn't work for you, and applying yourself to it.
Okay.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādeme. Svākāto bhagavatā dhammo dhammaṃ saṃ. Supatipanno bhagavato sāvaka-saṅgho-saṅghaṃ namāṃ.